Laura, are you ready yet?
Blue man's on.
We'll order the House Committee on Health Care and commend the staff for their transition speed. It was like an Indy pit stop here. Hey, you guys got all the tires changed? Good job. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2009 for the purpose of at least discussing two things, depending on the time. If we have more time, we might discuss other things. But the beginning, we're going to talk about the question of what an essential benefit package means. We had words in the first bill called essential benefit. We talked about changing it to basic benefit, and it turned out essential benefit has some magic. The cell phones, could we all do what I'm going to do now, take their cell phones out of their pocket and purse and press off so it stops messing up the system here? Also, try and remind me on the way out to turn it back on if anybody. we're going to talk about what essential benefit package means, and we're also going to talk about the question of Kids Connect, the question of how we can maximize kids, which include taking some kids at under 200% of the poverty line into Medicaid, going from between 200 and 300 in a different model, and something over 300% of the poverty line, and we'll be talking about those things so we understand what it is we're talking about. Tom, can I ask you to join us and be our guide through this thicket today? You can take any members of your excursion along with you.
Mr. Chair, members, Tom Byrne, serving as health policy consultant to the chair. House Bill 2009, as the chair just identified, has a requirement that the health fund board create an essential benefit package. The health authority create an essential benefit package. The term essential benefit package has never been defined in the bill. I'm not quite sure why. I think it was because I poorly drafted the concept paper that had some words around what we wanted. And so what you have in front of you, the document says new section, and these are the words that we initially drafted to try and define what the essential benefit package is, and these words are directly out of the September version of the Health Fund Board report. I think the question that you have to decide is, do you want to give any direction to the authority board in as to what the health fund, what the essential benefit package ought to look like? There have been some proposed amendments to the bill that would expand this definition to include various things like it has to be at least the Oregon Health Plan benefit level. There would be no deductibles, no copays, and that there be full dental coverage, and that there be full acupuncture coverage. Those are the types of policy questions that you're going to have to decide about, just how prescriptive you want this to be, whether you want to put any parameters around what the board does as it develops its package. The Office of Health Policy and Research has a great policy piece that they have handed out to you that goes into much greater detail about the package, and they are in the audience to discuss what was going on at the Health Fund Board as they created the package. In addition, Susan King, who was the chair of that subcommittee, is also in the audience, and she can help provide direction on how to proceed. So at this point, Mr. Chairman, I think the question is, how does the committee want to move on this? Leave it silent as it currently is in the bill, or start putting some boxes around it?
Susan Peters is who you mean, not Susan King? Or did you mean Susan King?
King, didn't I say that?
I have something in front of me that says Susan King.
Well, don't pay any attention to the notes I give you. It is King.
Susan King was co-chair of the benefits subcommittee. That I remember.
Yeah.
Susan, will you join us? And Dr. Smith, you want to join us as well, please? Okay, why don't you give us a little background? in whatever order you want.
Chair Greenlich and members of the committee, I'm Janine Smith, the Administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, and we help to staff the Health Fund Board effort, including the Benefits Committee, and I'm accompanied by Darren Kaufman, who's the Director of the Health Services Commission, who staffed the chair and its committee on developing the essential benefit package. Before you is this handout that has a summary, two and a half, on what an essential benefit plan is, based on our direction and what we needed to accomplish through Senate Bill 329. They were asked to determine what type of coverage or benefit plan was absolutely essential for safeguarding the health of Oregonians. And they felt that they proceeded with the concept that it would be based on the Oregon Health Services Commission's prioritized list of health services. It has been time-tested and been in implementation through the Oregon Health Plan since 1994, was developed in an open public manner to reflect the values of Oregonians. It uses evidence-based medicine in determining coverage priorities and prioritizes preventative care and chronic disease management quite highly and aims to promote population health. So the essential benefit plan does is tries to crosswalk what we have done with the list over the years in the health plan with a commercial type product. Inside the full detailed benefit committee's report, there's a figure one which outlines the structure in which what would be paid for and what couldn't. And I don't believe you all have that, but I know you received that report electronically perhaps. And basically, it's a comprehensive coverage package. All services currently covered by the Oregon Health Plan and on the prioritized list would be covered, with patient cost sharing increasing for services with lower priority on the list. So unlike what we do in the health plan, we say if it's below the line, we don't pay, but that you could have higher cost sharing attached if it was lower on the list, and possibly even higher yet to purchase those things that may be what we would say is below the line in the current Medicaid. The emphasis is also on first dollar coverage. There's a value-based services that are shown to reduce complications of disease and the overall cost of care, basic diagnostic services, and comfort care services, including hospice and palliative care. Other diagnostic services that have higher cost sharing than basic diagnostic services would be managed with evidence-based guidelines or prior authorization to try to manage that high cost and prevent overutilization. Ancillary services such as durable medical equipment are covered with cost sharing based on the priority of the condition being treated. They felt that we had an actuary come through and go through what they finally decided on in order to highlight what it would cost. There are some there's deductibles that will keep monthly premium costs down and discourage movement from private insurance into public programs. An enrollee out-of-pocket maximum protects against bankruptcy in case of catastrophic illness or injury. And it excludes services that currently aren't covered on the Oregon Health Plan, including cosmetic services, infertility, experimental treatments. So in essence, it's kind of the first really major attempt at trying to crosswalk what we have done for years in Medicaid with a commercial product. And I'll turn it over to Susan to see what I might have missed.
Chair Mitt Greenlich and members of the committee, my name is Susan King. I had the privilege of being the chair of the Benefits Committee on a pretty quick piece of work to bring forward to you a proposal, which is by no means complete. We had a short time to do our work, but I would echo what Janine said in that we really wanted to emphasize what you've been hearing a lot about in this committee, and that is primary care, the integrated health home, if you will, dealing with conditions before they become serious illnesses. So that is really the emphasis that we placed in our product that we brought forward to you. And we thought that one way we could do that, in addition to prioritizing into tiers, again, based on the prioritized list under the Oregon Health Plan, the current Oregon Health Plan, is also with cost drivers. Again, the first dollar coverage for services that we want to incent, higher copays and higher out-of-pocket costs for less effective or less desirable services, if you will. So it was a twofold approach, setting the priorities in our narrative as well as setting them through the cost drivers that Janine reviewed with you. There were a lot of pretty spirited discussions in our committee about all the populations that would be affected by this kind of a benefit package, and we recognize that there have been some concerns in the community that this is a very different approach. But again, as Janine said as well, we have experience with using the prioritized list under the Oregon Health Plan, and that was our direction that we got from Senate Bill 329. So I'll be happy to answer any questions that I can.
I have several.
I do too. You start.
Susan, are you referring specifically to Figure 2, which is the examples of essential benefit package with supplemental plans?
That's the overview.
Okay. It's in the
full.
Right, and I'm looking at it online. What was sent to me? The one thing I'm having difficulty in parsing this out.
Just to clarify, it's in the full Benefits Committee report, which I think you received as a separate attachment. And there's a Figure 1 and a Figure 2. And then the detailed actuarial work is in the back.
I prefer not to have a hypothetical question based on what's in the table, but if you have a substantive question, let's see if we can get an answer.
I mean, I guess my problem specifically is limiting what the Oregon Health Authority would be able to look at in like statute.
Actually, I hope it doesn't.
In fact, that would be my preference, is to leave it as open as possible, because I think there's, if they need it to be in statute, they can come back to us and talk, but...
Well, let's see if we can first understand what we're talking about, and then we can get to the language and to make sure we... I think there's some issues about what the heck are you talking about here, and let's see if we can figure that out.
Well, Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I think the committee would say that this was the first step at developing a package that could, again, thinking that 329 was sort of to look at maybe covering everyone, and at some point if you had an individual mandate and kind of if you went the Massachusetts way, you would have some minimal credible coverage, as often termed. So what would we kind of think that would be? And so this was an attempt to crosswalk with the prioritized list.
I understand what it's attempt to. Let's see if we get some questions about what it does.
No.
I didn't mean to slow you down.
No, I think the point that's been frustrating for me is show me what we're talking about.
Yeah, that's
right. In fact, you have done that, and I appreciate it. The problem is that I wish this had been like part of the overall, the end product, and not a side product that we're having to go search for.
Well,
but I think you've
understand it's a side product. I mean, I do not consider products of the subcommittee that were not included in the final report product of the Health Fund Board. So if we're talking about you've done some things that are not, in the extent to which they're not in the final report, I think they're not a product of the board. That doesn't mean they're bad ideas.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I think the Health Fund Board itself felt that, as per the also the committee, that this was a starting place that needed further work, because and that this was just the beginnings that could then, and I think the thinking inside the Health Fund Board full report is that this is a place to start, and as we move forward in further phases.
Could we deal with what the it is? Is anybody here that has any questions, including me, about what the it is that's the starting point? It would be very helpful to deal with it.
Well, I think I do, Mr. Chair.
Go for it.
Once again, trying to sort out what it is, and a fear that I have of as we're looking at this larger thing, to not exclude some things which I would consider, or maybe some people would consider experimental, but perhaps effective. One of the things that comes to mind is health savings accounts. The way they're structured, would the essential benefits package, the way that you've laid it out here, necessarily prohibit or inhibit us from looking at an HSA or a similar instrument? Or is it too early to tell?
Chair Greenlake and Representative Bruhn, I don't think so. It would be my opinion that the way an individual might secure the funding to pay for out-of-pocket costs might be through a variety of mechanisms. So we didn't talk about that specifically in my committee, but I can't imagine that this proposal would necessarily
okay, that's
preclude
great.
That.
That's great. I would hope it would. And a second, totally unrelated, but where in your discussions did the issue, where did you land on the issue of clinical trials within this?
Chair Greenlick and Representative Bruhn, at this point in the proposal, the experimental treatments would not be covered
that's
under our as essential.
Okay.
As essential, right.
You pass out a document here. Can I ask some questions from that document?
Mm-hmm.
Down under an EPB is affordable and financially sustainable. It says something about, maybe it's above it, but my understanding is that I'm coming in and I have a different deductible based on what it is my doctor prescribes. So if I come to see the doctor today and the doctor says, I'm going to order this test and I'm going to order this treatment, you say, okay, you've got a 20% deductible on that test because that's pretty high, but you've got a 40% deductible on this other thing because there's no evidence that that's effective. Is that what happened to me sitting in a doctor's office? Would I get this kind of?
Chair Greenlick, maybe. I guess a qualified maybe. Part of the discussion that we had, and one of my co-chairs was Dr. Saha, who serves on the Health Services Commission, we grappled with this. How is the prioritized list actually how does it play out in practice? Because we all know, those of us who are providers, that the patient doesn't walk in the door with one discrete diagnosis. They may come with a primary diagnosis of diabetes, but other things as well. So one of the issues was, well, how do you choose if they have something on line 22 and something on line whatever? How do you mesh those two? 210.
For the same illness, because these are service pairs we're talking about. Illness treatment pairs. So I could have a diabetes. I'm in here for diabetes, and I could have a diabetes and the proper blood test. I don't pay any coinsurance. Mm-hmm. I have diabetes and some other diagnostic. Down the list, I pay 20%. I have diabetes and an unproven treatment. I'm down the list. So I could be trying to figure out what my copay is, not only what the amount is that I'm copaying, but what the copay percentage on three things coming out of the same office. Is that how you envisioned it working?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Darren Kaufman. I was lead staff to the Benefits Committee. The prioritized list of health services, which this is based on, for the most part, has services, all services that the Commission feels are effective and beneficial, prioritized on the same line of the list. There are some instances where they appear on more than one line, but they're definitely the exception. So the commission.
About the same service.
I'm sorry.
Did you say the same service?
Different services for the same condition are usually found on the same line on the prioritized list.
Even if they're unproven?
No.
I mean, if I have an ulcer and my doctor wants to do a gastric freeze that's been long since discouraged, and if, as opposed to an antibiotic treatment regimen,
Chair Greenlink, the unproven services are actually not even found on the prioritized list. When the commission looks at new treatments that come out, they review the evidence behind those, and if they are it's not felt to be substantiated as a meaningful treatment for a condition, then the commission recommends that they not be on the prioritized list.
You
and be
need to help me again. I mean, I'm a simple person that thinks in terms of reality. I had to choose from among three different chemotherapy regimes for lymphoma. None of them were on the list, so that means I can't. My treatment for lymphoma is not covered because none of the treatment I1 are paired with lymphoma on the list?
Chair Greenlich, as this product is developed, that would be true at this point. If there's not evidence that it's linked to effectiveness or treatment for the diagnosis, that would be true under this proposal.
So 50% or more of the office visits in this reality would be not covered by health insurance because what the doctor was doing there wasn't proven to be effective?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, I think that the thinking was that there would be means in which you could buy supplemental coverage on top of the essential package to cover those things and or tier.
I'm not talking about supplemental. I'm talking about any treatment for my lymphoma. If you don't have something on the list that I can get treated for my lymphoma, then it's not covered by health insurance because science hasn't caught up with the treatment yet. I really do need to understand what you're talking about. This is a sort of weird concept.
Chair Greenlich, the prioritized list, I don't think goes into the level of detail maybe that you're talking about. We do have a line item on the list for medical treatment of lymphoma, and including chemotherapy. It doesn't get into the details of different regimens. I think that's left up to the provider in consultation with the patient in terms of what works for them. But, you know, there will clearly be some oversight by the health plan to make sure that what is being prescribed is not experimental.
Well, what about your words here? Under EBP excludes services currently not covered by the health plan. And that bullet says ineffective treatments or treatments that have little impact on health. Mm-hmm. If it's not on the list, it hasn't. I mean, is it by definition not having impact on health?
Chair Greenlich, it's difficult to answer the question when you're talking to the person that is experiencing the health condition. Maybe what I could do is refer back to a discussion that we had in the late 80s when we were talking about the first prioritized list. What the committee was talking about, and these are very difficult conversations. They were difficult then, and they were just as hard when we had them. There was a particular case which received a lot of press here in this legislature and elsewhere where a gentleman was seeking a liver transplant for his mother. Some of you may remember that. And there was no evidence then, or probably now, to suggest that that transplant was going to prolong her life, make her health status better, or, and I hesitate to say this, be worth it in terms of a cost-benefit analysis. And so that was denied under the prioritized list under the Oregon Health Plan.
Now, I'll match history with history. I mean,
well,
we had a case
I
not that long can. Ago where because of the way the health plan was formulated, the health plan would pay for a lung transplant or a heart transplant, but not for a heart-lung transplant. Mm-hmm. I understand the priority list, but the priority list has things that are covered and things that aren't covered, but lots of medical care that's not either of those two things. And my assumption is something that's way, way down the list I can get at a higher copay, but something that's not on the list, I can't get at all. Or I can't get covered. I can get anything, but I can't get it covered at all. I mean, I'm just trying to find out if this is the model that we're asking the Health Authority Board to craft when it begins to think about how to create a blank benefit plan, basic benefit plan, complete benefit plan,
minimum.
Essential benefit plan. So I think if we're going to say give instructions, we want to make those instructions clear. And if I can't figure it out, I think it may be hard to pass on to others as well.
I have a different question. I think it may be much simpler to
get me out of this
answer. That is, I'm trying to understand. So there are value-based services, basic diagnostic services, and comfort care for which there's the deductible does not apply and cost sharing is very low or non-existent. Are those particular lines from the prioritized list that qualify as those things, or would there be some sort of review standard of what types of services qualify as value-based services shown to reduce complications and overall cost of care, basic diagnostic services, comfort care services? How do those interface with the prioritized list?
Representative Cannon, members of the committee, this basically was a new concept of the Benefits Committee, and so would basically go beyond the structure of the prioritized list right now. So as you suggest, it would require a new review to determine which services on the prioritized list would be considered value-based services.
Okay, and I have a follow-up that's only probably slightly related. Am I correct in thinking that putting the cost share and deductible issue aside, so putting the aspects of private kind of coverage that you've overlain here to the side, this really uses OHP as a kind of starting point because OHP is based on a prioritized list, and it would be your considered opinion that that process of developing the prioritized list has been an effective one at determining what the most sort of important and cost-effective elements of care are. I guess my comment, and maybe it's a question, is can we be sure that we're not putting the cart before the horse? I mean, if the starting place for this essential benefits package is OHP, I just want to be confident that, and I know only a little bit about the history of OHP, but enough to know the kind of work and extraordinary minds that have over decades been working on that prioritized list. But I do want to at least acknowledge that setting the baseline as sort of OHP does give the authority a lot less discretion, and certainly, that I just want to make sure we are really confident in that decision to say, okay, OHP is as good as you can get. This prioritized list is sort of golden, and we're going to overlay some private features on top of it, but we're really not going to get at the underlying kind of assumptions and decisions that have been made around OHP and the prioritized list.
This is nowhere near as good as OHP, because OHP Plus pays for everything that's on the list, and this does not pay for everything.
Right, the cost sharing piece is where we start to tinker with it, but the assumptions about what the most cost effective services are and what the most essential services are not made independently under this. We use OHP's decision making around that and say that's the starting place, but you're right, we pay for it differently.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Cannon, let me see if I can start, and then I will certainly defer to the experts who deal with the prioritized list on a daily basis. First off, my committee was directed by Senate Bill 329 to use the prioritized list in our consideration, so we did have initial direction. What we recognize, particularly since we had a member of the Health Services Commission on the committee, is that, first of all, this is a volunteer commission, and so they can operate the prioritized list, but there are many questions about how one diagnosis interrelates with the other, how treatments for more than one diagnosis, what is the evidence base for choosing one thing or the other, that there are a lot of discussions that the Health Services Commission can't currently have simply by limitation. So we wouldn't say to you that this is the end point, but what we're saying to you is that there has been, as you say, considered opinion over a number of years about how to rank and how to rate different kinds of diagnoses and their related treatment. That was a place for us to start. Yes, we did deviate because the cost sharing is a very different concept. But what we were operating from, our overall goal, was talking about what should we consider essential for the whole population, for you, for me, for anybody. So we didn't particularly have our Oregon Health Plan hat on. We were charged with coming up with what, if we had something that was universal for everybody, what should it look like? But we recognize that there's a lot of work around that prioritized list that isn't able to get done right now. And I will certainly defer to Janine and Darren.
And Chair Greenlick and Representative Cannon and members of the committee, the list
is constantly updated. They did an extensive overhaul of it, looking at chronic disease more specifically, and re-looked at the entire list just over the last 2-3 years, more than has ever been done in almost 10 years. So it really was a place to start to try to get what currently in most of commercial plans, there's a in the buried in your booklet is a thing that says limitations and exclusions, and then there's sort of decision making inside each of those plans over what that is. So this was trying to be more overt and put more standardized, perhaps, and using as much evidence as currently available, which is much more than in the early days of the list, but is much more extensive. Yet there's many things there's not good evidence yet, and so there will be some judgment down the line by individual plans, but it at least was kind of a way to try to capture that somewhat nebulous term of limitations and exclusions by going through the base of the list as the base to start from.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Could you say a little bit more about the higher cost sharing for the emergency room? You know, I certainly understand and appreciate the concept, but I can also, you know, imagine a number of circumstances where things just flare up and need emergency room treatment, I mean, not to mention accidents. So I wonder about the higher cost sharing for that when it's not necessarily something that's avoidable.
Chair Greenlick and Representative Dembro, yes, we had a pretty lively discussion about that. Where we chose to land was to say that there are some points in an emergency room visit that few would debate. One is you meet admission criteria to an inpatient unit of some kind, or you meet transport criteria through EMS. We believe that there is, in fact, as a clinician in an emergency department, there is a great deal of emergency department use that might feel urgent but isn't truly emergent. So we were trying to really focus on emergency care versus something that you would like to have tonight but probably don't need tonight. I would say that, again, this is a starting place, and this is a proposal that would operate best in the perfect world where you had access to a primary care provider in a timely manner, not necessarily during your workday. So whether you think the 50% copay for a person who wants to go tonight or feels badly enough that they choose to go tonight to the ER, but they don't meet either a transport criteria or they don't meet admission criteria, whether that's reasonable or not, would depend on what the system is around.
And not knowing there's going to be a $1,000 copay if it's a $2,000 visit. Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's cold.
Cold.
Okay.
I really feel I use the reasonable person theory and think I need to go to the emergency room. I've got a temperature. I'm feeling bad. Something's happening, and I'm a reasonable person and using, which is now common language, right? The reasonable person theory. And I go to the emergency room, and they say, yeah, you're really sick, but you probably don't need me to be admitted. Something a doctor told me when it turned out both my quadriceps had been taken off my knee. Well, why don't you get up and go home? We don't need you. So anyway, if I did, then I would have ended up paying a 50% copay, and that emergency room visit would be, what, about $2,000 now? Is that something like that? So I would have been acting reasonably, and all of a sudden find myself with a $1,000 bill. You think that's not cold? That's very cool.
Well,
I probably wouldn't do it the second time. Yeah, it would be a learning experience.
What if you are a reasonable person and you have the urgent care in one door and emergency room in the other door, and you say, well, what the heck, I'll go to the emergency room.
Well, if both doors are there, I don't have a problem, because all they see when I show up in the emergency room is, please go next door.
Right. And by the way, here's your bill.
No, I don't think they would send you a bill at that point. I mean, if it literally was that.
You know, all of this, I appreciate this. This is, I'm actually very enlightened. But the issue is cost. If we can't afford whatever we're going to do, then we're not going to do it. And I think that instead of saying, you know what, this is the list of services that I want, and then go to the store or insurance store or to the state or whoever and say, okay, this is what I want, just send me the bill, I'll pay it. You go in and you have a budget and you say, this is what I'm willing to pay, what are you willing to give me in return for that? And I, quite frankly, I think that that's more of a reasonable approach. This is how much I can afford, what are you going to give me for that? And then, you know what, if we as a society can't afford the proton radiation therapy machine at $150 million a pop, then I guess we're not going to build anymore. And so, you know, I just think the whole issue of cost is going to drive it. And you know, we can squeeze the turnip, we can squeeze the balloon and try to get more dollars into the system, but at some point that really just drives the train in what we're going to be able to provide. And we have to make decisions about what we're not going to service. And I think your tearing out ultimately gets to that point.
But you can suggest, Representative Maurer, that we can have, here's how much premium and I can afford to pay and how much copay, and then you can create a set of different kinds of things for that amount of premium.
I absolutely agree. And you have different benefit levels. I think it, one of the interesting, if I can cite, your essential benefit package has a deductible for a family of
$15,000. $15,000 deductible?
Correct. I mean, am I...
I don't get covered until I spend $15,000?
No, out-of-pocket maximum.
Well, I would assume there are first-dollar coverage for preventive services. Yeah, for value-based care, basic diagnostic services, and comfort care. Is that correct? I'm looking at figure 2, page 27.
Well, and the word here says a high deductible will keep monthly premium costs down and discourage movement from private into public programs. It's that first bullet on the bottom of the second page. I was going to ask about that same thing.
Representative Maurer, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Again, I think the Benefits Committee, you know, struggled with some of the same things that you're bringing up. You know, trying to balance the issue of how much an essential benefit package would cost and then again, what it can cover. And again, this was kind of laid out as an example. I think that there were quite a few members that were a bit uncomfortable with some of these levels, like the deductible that you're talking about. And you know, through further work, I think that they thought that with more actuarial work, they could find other ways to bring some of these numbers down. But at the same time, you know, they were looking at what were the kind of gross estimates of what a benefit package would cost. Again, the essential benefit package was meant to be, you know, the basic essential floor. So what the minimum amount that would have to be offered, with the idea that in probably a majority of the cases, as Chair Greenlick mentions, many would choose to pay a bit more in premium to get lower deductibles and less copays in their coverage.
Or and possibly more services. So this is really more like, you know, this might be the bronze level, and there could be a silver and a gold above that depending on what you want to invest in. Or lead.
Mr. Chair,
would you feel comfortable? You just used some words that would make me comfortable. I was just thinking of rewriting this whole section and substituting basic benefit package for essential benefit package. I mean, I had assumed that was not synonymous in this case. That's why we're back having this discussion. I crossed all this stuff out and wrote in basic as we were writing it, and then somebody pointed out that's not the same. I just heard you using it synonymously. Would you feel just as comfortable if we said the job was to define a basic benefit package?
Well, Sure, yes.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I think there is some history about the language.
Basic benefit package has a long history of common knowledge.
Right, and that actually that was the direction of the Health Services Commission in developing the prioritized list that would be used to develop a basic benefit package. And I think many believe that the benefit package that resulted from that process is actually quite comprehensive and might go beyond what most would consider a basic benefit package. So I think that therein lies maybe some of the desire to move away a little bit from that basic language and go a next step to essential. But
so you would substitute a sub-basic benefit package for that. That would make you feel more comfortable.
Chair Greenlink, I think this discussion is the discussion, and if I could say, what we really were trying to do is present something to you. Now, maybe the percentages aren't right, maybe the copays aren't right. This is just an example, but to me, and this is more than a semantic discussion to me, what we were trying to say is these are the services that we think will best protect health status or promote good health status. Basic to me suggests just what you are saying. You know, we have basic and then we have the sub-basement and then we have the higher levels. So what we were trying to convey to you is what we believe are important services for anybody in the population. Certainly, there are always going to be individuals who choose to pay more, can pay more, and want more services. But essential was the word that we were using to hopefully convey something different to you. And if we fell short, I apologize.
Well, and I think in the language that we have in front of us, I don't know whether, Tom, will you show them the language? You have that. I mean, I think there are things here that indicate we're really talking about something different. I mean, there are issues like requiring little or no cost sharing for evidence-based preventive. I mean, there are markers here without having to relate to...
Mr. Chair, is this your language that you're...
No, this is the language that came out of the final Health Fund Board report.
Okay.
So we wrote the first thing, we didn't use some of this stuff.
Right.
We stripped out. So the question is, do we want to put this back in this form instead of the form that it's in
right
currently
the issue that's before you, Mr. Chair, is that we have asked the authority board, the health board, to create an essential benefit package, and that's all it says currently in the bill. The question is, do you want to put any kind of parameters around that discussion? Clearly, the health fund board went down the path to create something that may or may not ultimately work. You don't have to necessarily adopt or even consider what they have in front of you.
Right.
The question is, do you want to put a box around the words that direct the board to create an essential benefit package?
The current version we have is a basic benefit package, right, rather than essential benefit.
The original... the original bill.
Mr. Chair, using the language from the Health Fund Board, I'm comfortable with it. First off, I think it leaves out a personal investment. I mean, in E, it says rewards patient for actively participating in their own care. But there's nothing in there about failing to be invested in your own outcomes. I mean, ultimately, you are. But
are you saying you are feeling you feel comfortable with substituting this, or you do not feel comfortable?
Ultimately, I do not. I think the language we have is
a better place to start.
A better place to start. Because
I think that too, actually.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. What language are we talking
about? Right now? Where we find out what that is.
Because I think all we have is whether we want to call it essential or basic, and there is no language, unless I'm missing something.
There is no definition.
But what does it say in the... What are the words we have in the current
version?
That's
what I want. I don't know.
It says, the board shall create...
Find the words.
What section?
Section 10.
Well, we're going to look at that on Friday evening.
This is... Establish a Essential minimum basic benefits package.
Okay. Essential
minimum. No, he's. We
hedged that. Minimum benefit package.
Did you say essential minimum benefit?
No.
Oh, yeah, we cross out essential minimum.
I'm being facetious, Mr. Chair.
We did cross out and say a minimum benefit package.
Right.
As defined in Section 10A of the SAC for all insurance offered through the health insurance exchange.
Okay. Does anybody here think we ought to change that to something else, including what's in front of us? I hear Representative Maurer suggesting no. Is there a
yes?
Yes, sir.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that
comment
is all yours.
Wait a minute. Let's hear this in front of us so we can talk about it.
I think that the work that the Health Fund Board has done to help guide the development of this essential benefit, basic benefit package is instructive and provides the framework for the kind of direction that I think we want to give the health authority as they develop this. I think this notion of increased cost share for services that are less cost effective and more discretionary is significant. The lower or zero cost share for services that are determined to be cost effective and health producing ought to be a fundamental component of this essential benefit package, whatever they decide. I mean, clearly we're not going to get to the level of detail of here's what the deductible will be at this premium. I mean, that's not here. But I think these principles come close, at least, to the kind of guidance that I would feel comfortable giving to the board, the authority.
Representative Kotek, did I see you?
Yes, and I think Representative Cannon captured that precisely. Thank you.
There are two options in front of us. I think I'm going to ask each of you to comment on it as we find out how to go. Where we have it now doesn't say anything about it except the benefit package, except a minimum benefit package.
Mr. Chair, it does a little bit more than that. In Section 10I, it says establish a, insert the word, the adjective benefit package, as defined in Section 10A. And then 10A does go a bit further, the purpose of which is to define the minimum benefit package and establish timelines. I don't know if we've got timelines in here, but this does go, I think,
is this
a good ways towards.
Is this
a
new one
10A
we're going to be
is.
Talking about
no.
Friday? No.
This is the one that when we reviewed the whole committee, we talked about this. And we were room 50.
Yeah, after talking about it, we've changed it now, and we'll be talking about it, right? 10 on Friday, which was sent out. Is this the one that was sent out?
No.
Okay.
Representative Parker is.
You got a different one on Monday. A different version,
good.
Right? Of 10, 11, 18, and 20 to be discussed Friday. It was emailed out to you and the public.
Yes.
And that's what we think we got out of what we're going to share with you is what we think we got out of the conversations we had about these sections.
I was given this earlier in the week.
And do you have that in front of you?
Yeah. And it says
what specifically does it say?
Establish a health benefit package for all insurance offered through the exchange.
And that's all it says.
That's all it says. Now, there have been various other versions, and you're right. When we were in front of you and talked in room 50, we did try and put a box around it. It became clear in the conversation that the box wasn't working. So we withdrew it for this. Others have come forward and said the box needs to be there, and we need to put something in place. And that's the issue that's before you.
That's where we are now. So the real question, and we can wait till Friday, actually, wouldn't hurt to keep this, and I hope you'll all have a chance before Friday to look at the material that was sent out that we see as the kind of final version of the final version going to the LC to create an amendments that we'll then act on formally, and we can put this in it. But the issue is there's no question the Health Authority Board would look to the report of the Health Fund Board and when they started to do this and say here's what they thought. The question is, do we want to put it in the statute directing them? So the question is, and I would like to hear everybody's comments, but I think we can wait till Friday when we deal with Section 10 again
to look at it.
Can I make just one particular comment? It's not at all clear to me why A on the proposed new section is here. If this is to define the essential benefits package that would guide and, in fact, have the force of law on all benefit plans offered private or public in the state, I think I'm right in that, then why would we... I don't think our intent, though, is to ask private carriers to subsidize insurance for people at low income levels. There's, which
no.
A says that they a benefit plan offered in the state shall not cost people living at federal poverty level money. Well, that may be the effect of public action, but it's not part of the essential benefits package.
Well, this is what all we have here is what came out of the health fund board.
I agree.
And it isn't clear. This is a complicated business, right?
Mm-hmm. We hope so.
What I understand, the basic notion, what hasn't been decided, for example, is if all health insurance has to be in the exchange or some can be sold outside the exchange. That's an open question we're leaving open. It hasn't been decided whether if you have health insurance outside the exchange, it has to follow the same rules that health insurance inside the exchange has to carry. So those things are open, and we have no intention of closing those questions in where we go with 2009. We're going to leave them open. But as I understand the underlying idea of a basic benefit package is, at least in the exchange, every carrier would need to offer at least a basic benefit package, but they could or could not offer something either supplemental to it, a basic benefit package and basic plus, or anything else. So all we're talking about here is trying to direct the health authority board what they should be doing at creating that minimum package that everybody in the exchange needs to offer. And you're right. I don't think this would be... That's not an issue of benefit. That's an issue of how you finance whatever benefit is offered. I mean, that's absolutely true. Let's start from... Oh, you had some questions.
I can wait if you want to start.
No. No, I wanted to... Let's get the questions out, and then I'd really like to hear everybody's perspective on it.
Well, as I read this proposed new section, I find the language a little bit confusing as to whether we are just itemizing things we want to be considered.
That's what it says.
Well, but some of the subsections are fairly prescriptive in what we want the final product to include. I infer from this a little bit more direction as to the final product than we may be saying we want. So I have no problem saying that the board should consider the following list of values, of principles, but some of the language here about, for example, requiring little or no cost sharing, that suggests to me that we expect a final essential package to reflect that. And maybe we want that, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't just say the board shall consider it.
You'll see some changes as we dealt with 18 and 20 to deal with exactly this, Representative Garrett. And you're right, this is ambiguous. And what we tried, as you see those sections we'll discuss on Friday, we made clear, we said, in this case we would say, your plan shall do these things, and then you should consider these other 14 things as you're crafting your plan. This is I would absolutely agree with you.
That's my only point.
Yeah, I mean, it could say the way we want it. Consider the extent to which little or no cost sharing is, or the extent to which cost sharing is included. I mean, that would make it more grammatically related to what I think we're trying to do.
Well, I think that responds to Representative Maurer's desire to leave as much, let the board go do its job. Without being overly prescriptive, while still enumerating things that we think clearly the health fund board took into consideration and considered important, and we want those to be absolutely in the analysis.
On their mind, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, rather than going around today, let's leave this for Friday. It'll give you a chance to think about it. The options could be...
Tom, do you have a... Well, before I get too broad on a limb.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, remember, Friday's discussion is the duties of the board, authority, exchange, et cetera. This can ride separate or part of that discussion. So I would suggest that perhaps instead of saying as part of Friday, it should be in addition to Friday.
Well, no, I think it's a part of Friday because if we think the words that are in there as we look at it Friday are sufficient to go where we want to,
good point,
then we don't have to consider
that's true.
This. If we want to make it a broader statement, we can either put some of this into that, or you're right, we could create this as a separate,
yes, yeah,
a separate section. Senator Thompson?
Mr. Chair, one of the concerns I have in this discussion, and it's probably my warped view of the world, but I see us debating level of service delivery against cost, which is rationing against cost. I don't see the philosophical change in the way we want to do medicine. To me, the basic package should include health management for chronic disease and some sideboards. You get the best coverage if you're in an ongoing asthma management program and you're adhering to that program and your outcomes are measurably good because you're adhering to it. On top of that, then, an acute care piece for you get ill or fall down the stairs. But I don't see where we're changing the direction of healthcare delivery by playing off a list of services against costs.
I perceive, and I think your question is a really important one. I can tell you what I perceive that this is a way to use co-pays to encourage the kind of things that you're talking about. I mean, precisely, to have a zero copay to be involved in chronic disease management and to have a big copay for you doing something stupid.
Yeah. Ultimately, we need to have a system that disincentivizes people who want to live life dangerously and then go to the physician for symptomatic relief whenever they've screwed up their diabetes or asthma or whatever they're doing, as opposed to the people who recognize they have a responsibility for their health care. They need to be in a management plan with a health care team, which doesn't necessarily involve a doctor. And, I mean, nurses can deliver a lot of this kind of care and keep the patient out of trouble. And we then are lowering costs as we move into this thing as a sort of a philosophical bench instead of you can go see the doctor whenever you want to, but we're only going to cover these services or we're only going to pay this much. That doesn't change healthcare delivery in my book.
Well, in terms of trying to deal with the tactical questions of steering a very complex bill.
I'm probably ahead of the game.
Through this legislature.
Yeah.
What I've been trying to do in terms of my tactics is to strip out any of those debates, to put in a place for those debates to happen over the next 2 years, okay, but save us the trouble or the impossibility. I mean, you worked on this for a year and had tons of trouble. So what I've been trying to do is to pull out any of the issues that would cause us to have that debate here, because that's a tough debate.
It is.
But put a marker in to make sure that debate happens.
Good. That's good.
That's what I'm trying to do tactically. So that's what as we look at where we go with these and with the amendments we'll be covering over the next couple of weeks, which we're going to be getting lots of them, that's what's on my mind. Put markers in, put mileposts in, and not slow up or stop the process of this bill or lose the votes we need to get because
I fear without those markers we're going to do what we've been doing for 20 years. We're going to talk about health care reform, which is really just a playoff of services against dollars, and that's not health care reform.
I couldn't agree more.
Mm-hmm.
But where we have the argument is how you structure a health care system to get it, and there's the one model. We do it by putting the burden on the individual and the individual's pocketbook or another model would be we figure out how to structure the healthcare system where those rewards and those incentives are hardwired into it.
Yeah.
That's a philosophical debate of the first order and a very interesting one. Well, thank you guys very much. I really do appreciate it. You did extraordinary work in trying to get to where you got with this thing. You know, it might not hurt if we had an updated list to distribute to the committee. Is that available? Can we get something? I mean, I think that's
online.
That's pretty instructive. It's online. Okay, send a link to it. That would be great.
All right.
Next item, the easier one, right?
The easier one, yes, sir, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Tom Burns, health policy consultant for the chair. House Bill 2009 is built on the assumption that we are going to expand coverage for kids to provide 100,000 kids with coverage by increasing the federal match for Medicaid. This is going to be done in a number of ways. Obviously, those kids with less than 200% FPL or whose family income is less than 200% of FPL will be picked up by Medicaid. Section 126 of the bill begins or attempts to define what are we going to do for those kids who are the working or families the working poor between 200 and some cap. 26 says 300%, you can pick the cap that you want, and try and find some way to address that. So that's one problem that we need to resolve today. The other problem is that we need to figure out how to go out and get these kids enrolled quickly into the program and get them into the right place. And so the governor has proposed that we consider a program contained in House Bill 2117, which is a way to connect kids to the various benefit levels that will be available to them under the provisions of 2009. The language you have in front of you, the big, thick language package, which runs about 19 pages, is written to accomplish that goal. And the reason why it's before you is because right now we're betting on the come that if we bring all this money, we're going to get kids to show up. And we need a way to have a better marketing system and a better way to handle getting these kids tied into the right program. And so the bill would create a couple of things. Number one, the proposed amendments would create a couple things. Number one, it would create a program that I'm going to call Kids Connect. It's a sort of a one-stop shopping. If you have a kid and you want health insurance for that kid and you don't know where to go, you go to Kids Connect. It's a rebranding, essentially, of what DHS is. And Kids Connect would talk to you, and if you are a family that is eligible for Medicaid, you're automatically enrolled in Medicaid. If you are a family who is between 200 and 300% of FPL, you will be put into a program run by FEOP. If you have access to employer-based health insurance, the program is designed to help you buy your family into the employer-based health insurance on some sort of premium sliding scale. All of these are designed as a means to... if you're over 300%, you can buy into the FEOP program with paying the whole cost. So that's one. That's in a nutshell what this language is before you. I can either walk you through this language section by section if you want to consider it, or we can bring, as I would prefer, the experts up to try and help you understand it. But again, the goal is to create a mechanism to expand Medicaid addressed at kids in a manner that will make sure that we get the kids who are most needy and get them enrolled as quickly as possible into health care coverage.
And do we need, in order to do what you just said we want to do, which we want to do, do we need all this, or is there fewer words.
There are probably fewer words. I think if you were to look at Section 126 and consider whether that's enough, and I can read it to you while you're flipping. The health authority shall implement a premium assistance program to provide subsidies on a sliding scale to individuals and families with incomes at or below 300% of the federal poverty level to enable them to purchase employer-sponsored health insurance or private market health insurance products that are offered by the health authority board for insurance through the health exchange. That's one step. It goes on to say, the authority shall offer for purchase without subsidies the products described above for those kids and families who are over 300%. So that's very simple language. It doesn't have any of the detail behind it. And yes, you can do that for creating the program. There are some very specific sections in the language attached that would create the kids program, and essentially that is just Section 2, I believe, 2 and 3.
which would put more detail to the language that we currently have in that section.
Yes, exactly.
All right, let's hear about this. Can we bring Dr. Goldberg for this? Ms. Black? Mr. King back there? I don't see. There he is. Hi, Rocky.
You're doing such a good job.
And then we'll have Jim Lakes of OMA and Debbie Kaufman. I skipped seeing Ellen Pinney's name on the part before. Ellen always seems to get left out. You can join us on this one. Ellen, back there?
I don't see her.
Okay. Go for it, team.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today about the proposed amendments to provide health coverage for all children in Oregon. And I will reiterate a little bit of what Mr. Burns had to say, but basically I'll just kind of hit the high notes, and then I have experts on either side of me, Dr. Bruce Goldberg, Director of DHS, Rocky
Claudia,
King.
Have you introduced yourself?
Didn't I just say that? No, I'm sorry. Claudia Black, Health and Human Services Policy Advisor for Governor Ted Kohn.
I testified three times last week and didn't remember once. So.
You're right.
You're just ready to launch. These proposed amendments will provide an opportunity for uninsured children under the age of 19 to enroll in comprehensive health care coverage. And by the end of the biennium, we anticipate that 95% of all children in Oregon will have health care coverage. It's a comprehensive health care plan that includes dental, vision, behavioral health, and physical health coverage. And we are looking forward to an extensive outreach and enrollment plan that will focus on the hard-to-reach populations and multicultural groups. These efforts will begin on July 1, 2009, and the plan creates options, as Mr. Burns said, for all income levels. To address the possibility of crowd-out, most children must be uninsured for a period of 2 months to be eligible for enrollment. We are creating a simple application process that will break many of the barriers to enrollment. So all families, regardless of income, will use the same process, regardless of what program they ultimately qualify for. They'll be able to apply online. There'll be a single toll-free number that they can call. They also will be able to go to any DHS branch office or other outreach center, and currently there are over 200 of those in the state, and we're looking at expanding those. All families will fill out a very short and simple application form. Application assistance will be available when needed, and the children will be enrolled in the appropriate health care program based primarily on their family's income.
Claudia, is that simple application form already in
that,
in the works?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that yes, done? It is already. It's already
it's
been adopted. It was, I think, 13 or 14 pages in the past. Now it's
good.
3 pages and a signature page, and we could have gotten it on 2 pages, but we wanted people to be able to read it. So there are basically 3 available plans, and the first one is for incomes
up to 200% of the federal poverty level, and those kids will be enrolled in the current OHP Plus program, also known as Medicaid, and we figured that there'll be somewhere between 50 and 60,000 kids enrolled in that program, and there are no copays or no premiums associated with those under 200%. And then through the Office of Private Health Partnerships, there'll be a state-sponsored private insurance option which will be offered to families above 200% of the federal poverty level who do not have access to employer-sponsored insurance. And that should serve somewhere in the range of 15 to 20,000 kids. It's private insurance coverage and guaranteed issue, so kids cannot be excluded based on a pre-existing condition. Families that earn between 200 and 300% of the federal poverty level will receive premium assistance based on their income, but they'll have minimal cost sharing. Families earning above 300% will pay the full cost of premiums and copayments. And then there's a small number of families, up to 300% of the federal poverty level, who have access to employer-sponsored insurance. And FEOP, the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, will continue to provide coverage for those families. So this maximizes the employer contributions. Families under 200% of the federal poverty level in the FEOP program will have the full premium paid, and families between 200 and 300% of the federal poverty level will have premium assistance. Families enrolled in FEOP will pay copayments and other cost sharing based on their employer's specific plans. I just want to comment on the impact of the CHIP reauthorization. It really came at a great time for Oregon. It was signed February 4th of this year, and it creates some really good funding and policy opportunities that this plan is well positioned to take advantage of. So for one thing, it decreases the cost of the plan by about $20 to $25 million a biennium. And it includes new initiatives that will help us facilitate enrollment to the lowest income uninsured children. It gives us more flexibility in covering kids. But, and I think this is a really important point, if the state doesn't use its share of the CHIP funds, the balance will be redistributed to other states. So we have an opportunity now that we really need to take advantage of. We want to make sure those funds and that allotment for CHIP stays in Oregon. So,
Claudia, how does SCHIP differ from the kids in OHP Plus? I mean, what's the...
That, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that gets fairly technical. Either Dr. Goldberg may be able to respond, or we do have people in the audience as well.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Goldberg, the director of the Department of Human Services. The CHIP program is a program by the federal government that provides states an enhanced Medicaid match to enroll what had been when the program started, to encourage states to enroll more children and get them covered. And it covers children who are above 5 years old, above 133% of poverty, and who are under 5 years old, above, let me back up, children...
Whatever. Yeah. But every kid we brought in, if they were eligible for SCHIP, they'd go, whatever it's called now, they changed the name, didn't they? Would go into that rather than into OHP Plus? Is that right?
No. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, the SCHIP program is merely a funding mechanism. Kids who are in OHP Plus are funded either on straight Medicaid dollars or on SCHIP dollars. And it's really based on their age and their income. So there's a federal cutoff.
So it only matters to us. It doesn't matter to them.
Bingo. Correct. It's a seamless program and to anybody who enrolls. Some states have separate SCHIP programs. Many years ago, Oregon made the decision, which I think was wise, to have a single program for all kids, regardless of their federal match rate.
Okay, good. Okay, you want to, will you carry on and comments?
Can I
have a question?
Quick.
Yes, please.
Can we
please,
talk specifically about this, the language?
Can I ask one before we do that, Mr. Chair?
Please.
I was wondering if Claudia could do the numbers for the above 300% of FPL that would be paying full cost for the private product.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, on the back of this House Bill 2009 fact sheet that you may have in your possession, I hope you do, for the kids that would be covered above 300% of the FPL, we anticipate about 5,000 kids would fall into that category.
I'm sorry, what should it look like?
And this is very similar to 2007 numbers for healthy kids. One of the questions I had, Mr. Chair, was we have increased enrollment for kids in the health plan because of the increased need and a variety of things, growth in the TANF population. I'm just wondering if we have, these numbers sound similar to what we had in 07, so I'm wondering if we have newer numbers. I think they're still in the ballpark. I just wonder if they had changed substantially.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, this is really based on Oregon population survey numbers from a year ago. And I think what you're referring to, and appropriately so, is that over the last year, we've seen pretty dramatic changes out in communities. Our TANF rolls are up 20% from what they were a year ago. The unemployment situation means that there are individuals who were employed and perhaps had employer-sponsored coverage and their kids were covered a year ago who now, because they're unemployed, don't. It's likely that there could be more kids who would now qualify. We haven't run those numbers, and we're in the process of updating our caseload numbers. We'll do that in the next about 60 days or so, and hopefully we can have some better sense. But I think certainly, given the economic state that the country and the state are in, it's certainly likely that these numbers have increased a bit.
And just another follow-up, since...
Anyone you want.
So I'm looking at the chart. Thank you. That would be really helpful to get updated numbers. And maybe my memory's just failing me here, but when we had talked healthy kids...
But not.
It was primarily, Medicaid and using FEOP up to 200%. So are we looking to seek a waiver to use Medicaid or SCHIP match up to 300% for FEOP? And if we're doing that, why aren't we doing it for Medicaid as well?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, yes, we are looking at doing a waiver that would allow us to use Title 19, Title 21 funds for children up to 300%.
Oh, yeah. Rocky, will you introduce
yourself? For the record, Mr. Chair, my name is Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Office of Private Health Partnerships, which also administers the FEOP program. So we are, Representative Kotek, looking at developing a waiver to request federal funding participation up to 300% of the poverty level. The question in terms of why not for the Medicaid program, I'll let Dr. Goldberg answer that question.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, let me back up and just mention for a minute the program design. I think that really gets at your question. We've designed a program that, in essence, has children up to 200% of poverty and has them in the Oregon Health Plan. And we need, currently, we have approval up to 185% of poverty. We would need approval to go to 200%. We used to have that. Our last waiver request, they said, we'll only approve you to what you currently have funding for, but if you get funding for up to the 200, come back. We'll give it to you very quickly. The next question is when you move up above 200%. And certainly there's a policy choice there. We would need federal approval to either extend the match to FEOP, or we would need the federal approval to do that in the Medicaid program. So either way, we would need to go and get federal approval. This program is really designed with a policy choice that as families come above 200% of poverty, these are families that are more likely to be regularly employed, families that are more likely to currently be in the commercial health insurance market where parents are. And so the idea was to offer a commercial health insurance product for that group. We would still need to get a waiver, regardless of the policy choice, moving above 185% of poverty.
Thank you, Bruce. Follow-up?
Yeah, please.
Do we have any cost analysis to show the cost? I understand why we might want to move the children above 200% into private market, commercial market rates. I get all that. Just wondering if we've looked at, with the new match rates, if it makes sense what is the cost difference to allow children up to 300% using the SCHIP match to stay in the health plan versus moving over into a private plan, particularly if they, if their parents start working and earning above the 200%, we're then saying go into a private plan when they're already on the Oregon Health Plan and they have continuity of care. I just want to know, we have some policy choices here. It's a little different this time because the match rate is higher.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Kotek, first of all, we've had a policy decision or discussions around what happens when someone enters a program, for example, on the Medicaid Plus side, the below 200%, and moves to 205% because their income went up 20 cents an hour for that family. And we've talked about how we can allow people to move up and down a little bit without changing where their program base is. Likewise, if you have somebody that comes into the private sector portion and they have a private plan and they drop from 250 to 199% of the poverty level, do you want them to go through and, you know, a change of plan just because of 1% line? And what we've tried to land on, and we're going to figure out the operational piece of this, is how you keep people there once they get in, irrespective of how they move up and down sometimes that little line. Because I think that's important for families. I don't know if that...
But you wanted the cost piece.
And the second piece would be the cost piece. There's some trade-offs. First of all, we don't know for sure the health status of the uninsured population between that 200 and 300% as much in terms of our experience as we have with OHP Plus, for example, and the kids. I mean, we've got thousands of kids that we've been able to look at. So the cost piece right now is projected to be somewhat higher for the kids above 200%, I think, than for OHP below 200%, that is for the private sector. But a couple of things. First of all, it's based on commercial rates, which could be as much as 20 to 30 to 35% higher, which provides a different network, a different access, especially in some of the rural districts of the state. So there are some of those. We know that with the FEOP population, for example, that transferred from FEOP to OHP because of the shortfall in federal funds, that preliminary figures are that they're not as expensive as the general OHP population in terms of the adults. That's not the kids, but in the adults. So we're still too early in that stage to come to a final number, but our sense is right now that it's a little bit more expensive simply because of the reimbursement piece with the docs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing this line of questioning. I would just like to see some analysis because I think things have changed a bit since 07. I'm not saying I would disagree with this plan, but I think we have to look at all options. And I think there's a real value in parent choice. I do think there are folks who will want to be in a commercial product for a lot of reasons. There might be folks who are perfectly happy. We have got some fabulous managed care plans around the state are doing a great job. Why make them change if we can go to 300, whether you're in the health plan or if you're in FEOP or some other product? So just... that's just where I'm going with this, so I appreciate it.
Chair Greenlee, Representative Kotek, if you want, what we could try and do is cost out for you, you know, a comparable benefit package and a comparable group of children and what the cost would be. You know, the one issue that I though would bring up is in making that decision, you indicated having choice. And we always think that's a good thing. One of the issues as you move above 200% is that we're dealing with what may be 25,000 children, and I think that at some point, if we're going to really split that market, that you may not create a sufficient enough market for the commercial insurers to actually want to bid on that. And I think that needs to be a consideration. So you might want to look at making a choice between one or another simply for the ability to have that happen. But I just wanted to point that out as one of the considerations as we get above that. I just think it's and it also becomes a decision about the cost and the price as well. The smaller the market, that might be priced at a much higher level by an insurance carrier where there is less of a likelihood to be able to spread risk.
But
so,
and I agree, and I think that's an important point, and sorry, I don't mean to belabor this, but we don't know how many folks are going to stay in subsidy or premium assistance or FEOP.
Correct.
So if you take out the FEOP kids, do we know we're even at $20,000 to $25,000 for that private product that you're trying to price? So many variables. So. Mm-hmm.
We'll get you as best information as we can.
Thank you.
Dr. Goldberg, it's not often that I get to ask a member of the governor's cabinet to give me help in political strategy, but let me do that right now. There are three options I see, and I'd like you to, if you could analyze the three options from the department's perspective. Option one is to not do any of this material here. I mean, not, this is a bill, and just use the language you heard Mr. Burns read a bit ago that tells the health fund board to do, to create these three programs. Option two is to amend this language in a piece into House Bill 2009 as a whole cloth, or maybe some subsections of it, looking at it. And then option three is to run this bill, which is in front of us, right? It's in our committee as a bill, as I remember, Ms. Black. Run the bill separately as a separate bill, maybe making it contingent on getting the dollars that we would get from the provider tax. What do you see as the consequences of those three choices from what you're trying to achieve as a department?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, it's not often that a committee chair asks an agency head for political strategy. So, indeed, the tables have turned. I think one of the considerations is how much legislative direction you want to give, and that we want to receive. That certainly option one, which was very broad and vague language, actually, to me, took the direction out of both the legislative branch's hands and the department's hand, and put it into a health authority that we at
authority will be the department,
right? But at this point, we don't know what that's going to look like.
That's true.
And
it's got 2 years, as you pointed out. We are crafting it so it happens sometimes between now and 2 years from now.
So I think that's one of the issues there. Amending it into House Bill 2009 versus running a bill separately
has the same problem.
I think has the same problem. I think that from my perspective, and thinking quickly off the top of my head about what I think is needs some thought. My sense is that as a separate bill that's able to be amended and crafted and get the kind of language that both the legislature and hopefully we can make some comments on, from my perspective, that might be the way to go.
You can get to work on it quickly. Will it create a fiscal of some way that you can't deal with except if we have new revenue to cover it?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, certainly establishing a program like this will create a fiscal impact and will need revenue. Now, whether or not that revenue comes from existing general fund or from some other source is going to be a question for Ways and Means.
And this year?
And for the legislature.
Good. I think that's very helpful, and we will consider that and think. It is before us, so we have the opportunity to deal with it. And if that's the case, I think we'll, in either of those things, we'll bring it back and talk about co-chair has specific language and a variety of things, either whether we intend to amend this language into it or treat it separately. I think we, because of time, maybe the fastest way to deal with this specific language is to get it on the agenda as a bill, and get it up for public hearing in the context of the whole bill, because we always have the option of amending it into us, and then we can make a decision of how things are looking. But with the sort of concept that we're at least $4 billion short of a 2009-2011 budget at the moment, which we heard today, it's gonna make it very hard to fly on its own wings. She will have trouble flying on her own wings. But we could pass it as a bill and make a contingent on the funding available.
Absolutely.
So, Mr. Chair, is your direction then for us to work with staff to get amendments drafted for House Bill 2117? Is that what you're recommending?
Do you need amendments for it?
I believe there are a couple of changes that we would want to include.
How about if we schedule as soon as we can a public hearing where you may get some more input about amendments, or do you think it would be ready to go with amendments you know you already want? Let us know. Talk to Sandy particularly. We'll coordinate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Since two quick questions.
Yeah. Cool.
Section 4, page 2, A and B. Why do you have two separate paragraphs that say the same thing?
Slight difference, though.
Well, I know. I see the difference. But the point is, the authority may not require copayments or deductibles. Seems to me you could slide that all into one paragraph. And why don't you ask for copayments or deductibles for that middle group, although I believe there is a cost share, a premium contribution, so which may be the reason you don't want to have a copay or a deductible.
You do it through the premium.
You do it through the premium, which may be the case. I don't know. That was one quick question. Their question is on page 12. Moving into 13.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, we believe that's probably a drafting error. The not should not be included.
In B.
I'm sorry.
In B.
I'm sorry. Say what you're saying.
On page 2, section 4.
Yeah, on page 2?
Yeah.
Not page 12. Okay. Back to page 2.
Of the proposed amendments.
May require.
Correct. That's correct, Mr. Chair. Representative,
is that one of the amendments that you were proposing?
Okay.
No, Mr. Chair, that isn't one, but that is one we would be proposing.
You now have it on your list.
I think there may be some additional confusion because the word premiums is not in B, and isn't premiums the way that we're asking the folks to cost share between 200 and 300%?
Yeah, may require premiums. It's item C, right?
No, B.
Oh, but no more than
Mr. Chair.
Oh, it's treated in C.
I believe it was generally the intent to allow no premium subsidies for those between 200 and 300%, and minimal co-pays or cost sharing for those between 200 and 300%.
Okay.
You may want to look at that language. Claudia, what are the other two? Are they substantive amendments you're talking about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have done some work on the bill on the amendments when we anticipated that it would go into 2009. So there are some other changes, but I'm not sure I can pull them out right now.
There are changes you would make to a standalone version, and there are changes you would make to if you were amending it into the 2009.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's correct. We would make the same changes regardless.
Same changes. Okay.
Next, page 12, very bottom. The bolded print into the next page, 9A and B. And my concern there, because this was discussed at length back in 2007 about the prepaid managed care plans and accessing community health clinics and safety net clinics, my concern is that if you are in a capitated plan, a capitated plan, specifically, that you are really destroying the purpose of a capitated plan if you allow them to seek services outside their contracted providers.
And require payment.
And require payment. And I understand the community health clinic side of that argument also, but I think that there's still a lot of conversation about that piece of it. And hopefully these capitated plans are actually contracting with these community health clinics, which is a separate issue. So I just caution in that section because you're actually creating a financial disincentive for capitated plans. In fact, there are some capitated plans that have difficulty implementing it, given the fact they don't even have claims departments. So are we trying to have a capitated plan to establish a new administrative structure to meet this possibility? And I don't think we'd want to go there.
Yeah, we need to talk about that.
Okay.
That's a pretty separate policy, including school health clinics as well.
Exactly. I mean,
some of the same issues.
I absolutely support those entities, but I just don't want to mix oil and water.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, we'd be happy to work with you on that language.
Mr. Chair, and I want to thank Mr. Vice Chair for bringing up this particular section. Well, I have a question specifically to the department. One could argue, the way this is written, it doesn't say, it says shall reimburse. That doesn't mean, you know, typical reimbursement as we consider health plans. That could be a lump sum paid to those clinics once a year because they're seeing their folks. Is that correct? I mean, by rule, we could determine what we mean by reimburse.
Or a dollar a visit.
Or a dollar a visit, or
which?
Is that correct?
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, that's correct.
Yeah.
Because I do think it's complicated, and I think we should get
to that. Let's get into this.
Okay. There's a larger policy question here about how you are certain that we have a network and provider groups throughout the state to be able to care for low-income kids and adults.
Also think about language in the standalone that would allow a statement about contingent on having funds available or something. Think about how that might work so it would tie it to some other source of revenue. That'd be great, and we will get it up then fairly quickly. We'll fit it into our schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Chair, if we have additional comments, how do you want to handle this? Should we have our own amendments drafted to 2117 if we have additional changes? Because there are just some things that I think...
Why don't you work with them? Perhaps both you and Representative Maurer could work with them to perfect the thing in a way. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely. But I think these organizations need, because they were very interested in 07, and I actually just see the Willamette Dental addressing that. I'm sorry.
No. But, I was just going to bring that to your attention.
But the point is that they were very interested in that language because they have a vested financial interest in ensuring these patients go where they need to go.
Right. I think it might be useful if you both work with them generally on this thing and see if we could get in the way that we can move it. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Can I have Jim Lace and Kathy Kaufman join us? Is Ellen Pinney here?
No.
Okay. We blew her off again.
No.
No, she wasn't here. It's good. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you.
Whomever.
Sure. I'll be happy to go first. Chairman Greenlick and members of the Healthcare Committee, for the record, my name is Dr. James Lace. I am representing the Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society. I'm also a practicing pediatrician here in Salem, Oregon, and I get to deal with those very patients that we're talking about today. Our current healthcare financing system for the state for our children doesn't work as well as it could and philosophically as it should, which results in a population of about 116,000 children that don't have healthcare coverage. Children that don't have healthcare coverage end up with poor health outcomes. The science is very solid on that. The studies are irrefutable. Children that don't have a regular medical care home identified for them end up having to go to a higher level of care in an emergency room. For the record, you can note that the current average cost for an ER visit is $1,600, not $2,000. It's a little bit less than that. But it's gone up from $1,100 in the last year up to $1,600 now. So it's a whopping amount of money. So that's a big source of problem. Pediatrics can be thought of in two different ways. One is preventive health care, and the other one is identification and management of acute and chronic care conditions. To give you a simple example of preventive health care, we talk about vaccines. Society can save or can invest $1 in a vaccine and save $10 in not treating that same disease that can be prevented with a vaccine. So it's a huge difference to get those kids in for care, to get them preventive health care. The identification of acute and chronic care management likewise can be looked at the same way. If we can see that same child in our clinic for pneumonia, for example, and not have to go to the emergency room, maybe not be hospitalized for that same condition, here again, society can save a 10-to-1 ratio, just to give you an idea about the difference in the cost for that.
Yeah, I thought you also deal with growth and development as an important issue.
Well, I'm getting into that. Just hang on. So, got to get the crowd warmed up.
Get you warmed up there.
I am a primary care pediatrician. Oftentimes, pediatrics is thought of as this kind of kiddie medicine. It's not very serious, and don't worry about it. You guys don't deal with congestive heart failure. You don't deal with diabetes. You don't deal with chronic hypertension. You know, all these other conditions.
But you are dealing with diabetes.
Well, of course we do. Anyway, the bottom line is that actually, I'm not trying to, you know, brag or anything, but pediatrics is a very complicated care and how we approach that. One of the things that I do as a primary care physician, I need to have access to subspecialty care, not only for organ dysfunction. For example, if you have cardiac issues, I need to be able to go to see a pediatric cardiologist. I send my patient there, actually. But also in terms of all the ancillary services that we're talking about. If it's children's mental health, which currently doesn't work as well as in the state as it should, occupational therapy, physical therapy, medications, and the list goes on. This program that's being proposed, I think, addresses that.
Excuse me a moment. Yes. Steve, do you want a moment to testify? I have written testimony in front of you.
I think you've kind of covered our concerns and our satisfaction around taking everything.
Okay, great.
Thank you
very much. I'm sorry, Jim.
No problem. So anyway, we just want to make sure that, you know, this program will identify and actually offer services and funding for those services for children that have, you know, complicated medical conditions. The whole goal of this program is to improve the health outcome of children. We know that access to medical services results in better care for children. Early identification of these children while they're growing up, early identification of mental health issues, getting these children healthy enough to be able to participate in preschool programs, getting them into the schools to be successful, and then obviously to be able to finish school and hopefully to get a job and be productive members of our society, assuming that all the jobs come back again in the future. We do know that there's a huge disparity in health outcomes based on their ability to access the system. That is to say, children who come from different social groups, who come from different ethnic backgrounds, children of working parents without health insurance, and children of families who have gone on hard times and gone on government assistance, the outcomes for those children is very different. Just take a very simple example. If we can take a child that we identify that's having some relatively or potentially serious mental health issues, if we can work with them, get that child to be able to be successful in school, and obviously stay in school and not end up in the arms of law enforcement and not end up being incarcerated as an adult, that's a huge success as far as we're concerned, and that's one of the goals that we try to do. The health of children, I think, is a huge barometer of the general health of our society. Children are much more susceptible to the vagaries of our social infrastructure. That's on the local basis, that's on the statewide level, national, international level. I get to deal with children in developing countries, and I can speak firsthand about that. So I think it's very important that we have a health program that is very fundamental to improving the outcomes for the health of children in the state. We, as pediatric providers, not just pediatricians, but the whole gamut of pediatric providers, are very excited about the proposal that's in front of you, and we want you to put this into place, and we will work to make sure that all these children will get into adequate pediatric care in different levels and in different programs.
Jim, are you representing OMA in this?
The Oregon Medical Association and the Oregon Pediatric Society.
Great. Well, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Ms. Kaufman?
Chair Greenlich, members of the committee, my name is Kathy Kaufman. I'm the Policy and Communications Director for Children First for Oregon, a statewide nonprofit child advocacy organization. I'm also the co-chair for the Human Services Coalition of Oregon. I'll be very brief. We are thrilled by the fact that the finish line for covering all kids is in sight. It couldn't come at a better time, not only because of the incentive we've been handed by the federal government, and we're pleased by President Obama's recognition of the importance of covering kids in the middle of this financial crisis, but because right now in Oregon, as Dr. Goldberg testified, we have more families than ever in need of help. We have a tough few years ahead of us. I know that the budget cuts that inevitably will come out of this session are going to wreak havoc on families. This is something that we can do that will make a real difference in their lives. So as parents lose their jobs and lose their income, one thing they won't have to stay up worrying about at night is whether or not they can take their kids to the doctor. This is incredibly important for the health of our state, for the health of our kids, and for the health of our economy. As mentioned, those much-needed federal dollars are going to be critical. So thank you for your consideration. We very much look forward to the success of this bill and the great benefit that it will have for all of our kids.
Are there any questions of either of these folks?
Not much to argue with.
No, I think we all agree with you, and we really appreciate you being here to support this. It's all a matter of finding a way to do it.
Yes.
I think you're right. I think there is a possible light at the end of the tunnel, and we hope it's not a train.
Thank you.
Well, we want to be on the train, actually.
Good if it's not coming at you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anything else, folks?
I have one.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Mr. Chair, the Office of Health Policy and Research gathers up a state of the states report from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Mm-hmm. I have several hard copies as well as an electronic link for folks. So whoever wants a hard copy, just raise your hand. 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Everybody?
Five. Everybody? Really? Everybody? Okay.
Yeah, why don't you get us all?
I think I might.
Paperless links
for the birds. Well, we've got. Anyway, that's a good question.
Okay. I close the work session on House Bill 2009, and we are adjourned.
I'll get another one. Keep that.